Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And before we meet our panel, let's have a quick look at the front pages. So Sunday Independent is leading with that Labour are being eyed as a next coalition partner. The Business Post have a poll. They're saying battle lines drawn. We'll come back to that. The Irish Mail on Sunday are saying that the Fine Gael manifesto has a pledge to means test immigrants, and also they're talking about the chartering of a jet for deportations. The Sunday Times has basically coalition parties clash as election promises are revealed, and they have the various parties setting out their stalls there. We'll have a look at that in a minute. The Sun on Sunday is leading with another €825,000 down the pan. Massive spend on state toilet block. This was fixing the toilet block in the Department of Foreign Affairs, cost $825,000. They're using a picture on the front of a golden toilet. I think maybe there needs to be a slight disclaimer on the bottom of that picture. May not be actual toilet, but there you go. And then a number of papers, the Sunday World have it and the Mirror have it, and it is elsewhere as well, featured the news that Gerry Hutch is planning to run as a candidate in Dublin Central. Now, that is a packed constituency with a number of high profile candidates running, and we will come back to that story. But you can find a list of all declared candidates in constituency profiles on rte.ie/constituencies. So, our panel this morning, Professor Scott Lucas is a professor of US and international politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Dan O'Brien is the chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Elaine Loughlin is the political editor of the Irish Examiner. And Aisling Meehan is a farmer, a solicitor and a tax consultant. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Brendan.
Morning.
Would we start maybe, Elaine, with that the front of the Sunday Times and the various parties setting out their stalls, and maybe give us a sense of what everyone is saying at this point in the campaign?
Yes, and we have, as expected, Brendan, wall-to-wall coverage of the election, which countdown is on now, less than 3 weeks away till voters go to the polls on November 29th. And there's a whole plethora of promises across all of the papers there. We see Fine Gael, obviously, in the Mail on Sunday, making promises around immigration and possibly charging asylum seekers who come here who have the ability to pay for accommodation and other facilities that they receive. A weekly rate. We have it in other papers. We see that there will be a focus on housing with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael using the Apple tax for the likes of Help to Buy, to increase the Help to Buy. And then the Sunday Independent has a raft of bullet points that tell us what each of the different parties might be doing. And I think one eye-catching one is the Labour Party wants to abolish that contentious USC, but not fully abolish it. Instead, it would morph into a ring-fenced fund that would go towards tackling the health service, or perhaps the health crisis, whichever way you want to look at it. So we see as well that the Social Democrats, there'll be a fund to rejuvenate Dublin city centre as well. That's being pushed in some of today's papers. So across the papers, yeah, we're getting kind of an indication as to where the parties will be going. And of course, you can't rule out independence. I couldn't possibly go through all of the policies and areas that they will be focusing on, because we do know that they are a disparate cohort, but a cohort that does seem to be very popular at the moment among voters.
Yeah, and makes up a big enough force in the electorate, according to the polls. And also, we see there the Green Party plans to allow EV owners to power their homes with cut price electricity and sell spare battery power back to the national grid is one of their promises, just to give everybody a shout there. So the parameters are being set out, but kind of you wouldn't be saying yet exactly what the election might be about, would you?
I don't think so, but I think I'd maybe point to a poll in the Sunday Business Post today.
We won't come to that just yet.
It does lay out, though, the the intentions of voters, both the popularity of parties and also what the public think about parties.
And we'll come back to it. Scott, what's your view on what you've seen so far now in terms of the various promises?
I'm going to speak generally then, because I'm learning
as
a blow-in from
good,
all this. But
good,
I think there's
good.
Two things that strike me. The first is, and I think it's a real contrast to what we've seen in other countries, including my native country, including many European countries, which is rather than shouting right versus left, there is this focus here on what we might call valence issues, right? Housing is definitely there. I think transport is probably there to talk about. I think we're going to hear in a moment about issues for rural communities. In other words, day-to-day issues. And I actually find that really reassuring for the second reason. And that is, my home for almost 40 years was the UK. And we've really seen a breakdown in consensus politics in the UK. We've seen a breakdown on discussing these issues to find a way forward and maneuver forward. And we've seen the rise of the hard right there with the Reform Party. And so far, with the significant exception of immigration and all the toxicity that that can bring in, there is a fairly healthy discussion here in terms of, look, what are the issues that are going to matter for Irish voters on a day-to-day basis,
so
including healthcare?
One way of looking at that is that, like, in a sense, and Brexit probably really ramped that up, that the UK politics became a culture war in a way. In America, politics became a culture war. You were saying that, as you see Ireland, that has not happened here yet, which is very heartening, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, the one warning signal or blinking light is some of the tabs, and you referred to one of them this morning, will try to whip up this idea of the big threat of immigration. They'll talk about deportation.
Well, they're just reporting a policy, in fairness to,
well, when
to
they,
the mayor.
Now, it's not, you know, it's not just reporting on a policy when you then basically feature it in certain ways and when you refer to immigrants in certain ways in the tabs.
Okay, yeah, I do. Yeah, I don't think that they were being referred to in any certain way there. I think it was a fair report on a policy. So then, Dan, is the other side of this that an interesting piece that you picked out in the Sunday Independent, which is by a guy, Barry Walsh, the former vice chair of the Fine Gael Executive Council, basically saying, what does Fine Gael actually stand for? And Owen O'Malley kind of echoes this as well, that what do any of them stand for then?
Yeah, I think it's he claims that his former party, maybe it's his former party, maybe he's still a member, that there's been a shift towards style over substance. And, you know, I can't recall if he raises it, but it's certainly something I would raise, is that our continent has completely changed. There's a war on our continent with 1 million casualties. Donald Trump has just come back to power. He looks like he could cut a deal with Vladimir Putin, the most powerful man in Europe now, militarily. Russia's the most powerful country in Europe. If he does that, there's a huge implication for the security of our neighbours, our countries that we're very close to, whether it's Denmark or Finland or Poland. They're in the European Union. And then I see that Ireland is, apparently from a report in the Business Post by Sarah Collins in Brussels, that Ireland is not going to chip in and help defend Europe, as we did during COVID, when all the countries came together to issue common debt to deal with COVID. Now, I think Ireland's putting itself in a very isolated position if it chooses not to show solidarity with its neighbours. And I would also say, just in terms of the context,
I think we do
campaign,
offer support in different ways, but we just do not pay money for lethal weapons, correct?
That is correct. But we're in a completely changed situation where, you know, we have weaknesses. We spend almost nothing on our own defence. We're not in a defence alliance, unlike every single one of our North Atlantic neighbours, from Norway to Portugal to Canada to Belgium. And this issue is not being discussed. And
you're saying that the election is a parochial matter of the quotidian issues of how we live our lives rather than being about...
I certainly wouldn't put it in those terms, but I would say that there is a huge issue in terms of our security and our defence.
Okay.
And Europe has profoundly changed and we're not talking about it.
Okay. Scott, you picked that. I'll come to you in a minute, Elaine, okay, or to Aisling. Scott, you picked that piece by Barry Walsh as well. But there is a sense, is there, that the flip side of what you're saying about the discussion being on various issues and everything, and you're saying we don't have a left-right here, is there a kind of a slight... I wouldn't call it monotony or homogeneity among a lot of our parties.
Well, you know, Barry Walsh's piece, I think, is very interesting in terms of what you stand for and what you're trying to achieve. I mean, the first thing, though, is that a lot of these issues don't make, in some senses, for the most exciting headlines and the most excited reading, because housing is a complex issue to deal with when you try to deliver social housing or when you talk about first-time buyers. Transport's not the most exciting issue with respect to very good transport riders in terms of when you're trying to deliver rail or when you're talking about transport for rural areas. So I would come back a little bit on Barry Walsh's piece to say again that this issue of competence, and if Fianna Gael can say that it is competent, or Fianna Fáil can say it's competent, or another party can say it's competent, that's quite important. I think what he's trying to say beyond this is what's the vision? Where's the vision beyond this, say, taking Ireland in the next 5 or 10 years? Dan raises a very important point in terms of what Ireland's vision is vis-a-vis Europe at a time of crisis for the continent. But what is Ireland's vision in terms of not just handling the economy, but where you want to be 5 or 10 years from now?
Yeah, I suppose there is a general agreement on the local vision, which is we want better infrastructure, more housing, all of that. I saw Fintan O'Toole made an interesting point the other day that this will not be a what election, it'll be a how election, to your point about competence. It'll be people arguing over how they spend money or who's most effective at getting stuff done. So, Aisling, what do you think the issues will
be? I think you hit the nail on the head in that it was one of the, like, just the points I jotted down. I was saying, like, is there a risk here that a couple of different risks, I suppose, I identified. One being that the main political parties are too many things to too many people. And what I mean by that is, you know, that they need to stand by their principles and not to apologise for them. Because, and where it became relevant recently was that one of the rural independents, who shall remain nameless, made a, you know, voiced concern over something and said, I'm not going to apologise for that. This is what I stand for. This is what I was elected to go into government for. And I think we've seen
it. People were shocked.
But like when you see, I suppose, I've just, some of the political parties are flip-flopping on issues. You know, I'm self-employed, come from a rural background. And when you see, you know, things like, for example, recently with the tax changes, you know, I mean, there's been a rhetoric there. There definitely has been a shift in the main political party about their, you know, their ability to feel that they might have lost some of the rural voter. There's, you know, very, they're mindful of agri and to support agri and to listen to them. But then when you see in the latest budget, there was a change brought in, which was, you know, to agricultural tax relief. Now, not as bad as what happened in the UK, but still it was going to affect a lot of farm families, and it was going to be brought in from
the
1st of January.
The passing on of the land?
The generational renewal, yes.
Yeah.
And what they did was that, because obviously it was, you know, they saw that it was going to cause an issue in terms of passing the Finance Act, so they had to stall it. So what they did was they put in what's called, you know, that particular provision now is subject to a commencement
order.
A change in the tax relief that's available to help people pass on the farm from one generation to the next with having to pay little or no tax. So they brought in...
What was happening to it?
So what they were doing was they were bringing in, it was a clause, it was a technical piece, I suppose, about what's called the active farmer test. They brought it in under the guise that, you know, that too many non-farmers were buying up land, and it was a way to protect the agricultural tax reliefs to genuine farmers rather than investors going in to buy in land to try and transfer more wealth to the next generation availing of this relief.
Oh, okay.
But it was actually what the rule, it was catching a lot of genuine cases too. But the issue is that it was brought in unannounced, and the change was coming in from the 1st of January. And it was like, it it's the uncertainty, you know, it was kind of a knee-jerk reaction. And now it's been paused. It's in the Finance Act, but they said it's not effective now. It's going to be brought in under a Commencement Act. But, you know, it's the uncertainty. It's the flip-flopping. Like, you know, there was an agri-tax review that was, there was a Commission on Taxation review that was done and was published maybe 2 years ago now at this stage. And it brought in loads of experts. And it basically said, coming back to the issues here, that there's too much reliance on corporation tax and income tax. We need to widen the tax base. And that is maybe, you know, tightening up of the reliefs that are available for capital gains tax and for the likes of capital acquisitions tax. And then they're going down that route. But then when it came to populist decisions, they pause it. They're not going through with it.
Okay. Yeah, you call it populism or call it democracy. They're trying to reflect what the people want.
Or looking for
Elena,
votes.
Elena, the one that I think had some people slightly scratching their heads this weekend was yesterday. Fine Gael announced that they would be cutting the VAT rate for the hospitality industry, having stood firm on it up to the budget, and you know, against a massive push by the hospitality industry.
Yes, and there was almost immediate reaction to that yesterday when Fine Gael promised that they would reintroduce not the 9% that hospitality had for a number of years, but an 11%, and this would be on a permanent basis. So we had members of the opposition coming out vehemently against this, and actually today we have members of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil saying it's a bit annoyed that the government couldn't do it only a few weeks ago ahead of the budget,
but now can. Okay, but the leader of Fine Gael has been quite clear that this is a different thing, because that was a temporary measure and the 11% would be a full-time measure. So presumably we're going to see a lot of flux in stuff.
We are, and I think, Brendan, one of the interesting things today from the papers is housing, migration, and to a lesser extent probably economy are what are being the areas that are being focused on. And if you think back only to a few weeks ago, all of the parties wanted to put an emphasis on childcare, coming out with great promises for parents with young children. No real mention of it in today's papers. Similarly, the opposition just this week in the final days of the Dáil were
the
raising...
former opposition, I guess.
Former, outgoing opposition. Wanted to put an emphasis on, in a lot of instances, children with disabilities and supports for those of the most vulnerable in society. Again, I'm not seeing very much in the way of those type of issues in today's papers. So I think it's a symbol of how once you get into a campaign, you really are into the unknown, and issues can pop up and become the dominant issue, or in some cases controversy during a campaign.
Okay, okay. There's an interesting one actually in the Mail, Aisling, that and like there has been a discussion about, again, how government spending and how the government spends its money could be an issue. And I say government in the general sense there, whoever's in government. The Irish Mail on Sunday, tell me about this story Valerie Hanley has, which will sound extraordinary, I think, to people, about this building, the OPW and the Dublin office block.
Yeah, sure, Brendan. It was reported by Valerie Hanley in today's Irish Mail on Sunday that the Minister for the OPW confirmed earlier this week that the government agency will spend £260 million on a building it will not own after the 25-year lease. The figure is made up of 25 years rent at £8 million a year, plus an additional £60 million that has been spent on fitting out the newly built distiller's office block in Dublin Smithfield. And the plan is to relocate staff from the Chief State Solicitor's Office, Ordnance Survey Ireland, Insolvency Service, etc. So it only came out as part of the Public Accounts Committee. Also, a big issue was the fact that it wasn't going to be ready for staff until the third quarter of next year. And they'll already have paid a significant rent bill of £12 million before the property is even occupied. And then, you know, there was questions about, you know, any questions that were asked, there wasn't much of a response.
No, the Mail have not got a response from the OPW, as I understand. We've requested a response from them this morning as well.
Yeah.
Now, just for perspective, sure. I think there'll be up to 1,000 civil servants working there. So, you know, it's obviously a big operation.
Yeah, I think, but in the context, I suppose, of the recent other controversies, you know, there was the bike shed, and under the FOI request, there was a revelation that 1.43 million on a security hut at government buildings. And I think it was over 500 grand was spent on mechanical, electrical and security systems. And I'm saying this in the context of just this week, we have been we have been approved, I suppose, for grant funding, which is minuscule compared to the kind of money, sums of money that are here. But I suppose we got grant funding to put in solar panels on our farm, which will, for our own farm, and also we can sell back electricity to the grid. It's a farming grant available under TAMS, Targeted Agricultural Modernisation Scheme. We can qualify for a grant of up to 60%. And lots of farmers around the country have been availing of it. But oh my God, the paperwork in trying to apply for the grant and also in trying to get the money back from the grant. I delegated it to my husband, who is
and you were a solicitor and a tax consultant.
He is a project engineer, and it just went beyond me.
So you're a regular farmer trying to get
the contrast in what's happening here versus, I suppose, the standards that we were put to in terms of progressing our grant. There is no comparison.
Dan, is it true to say that we are? The government governments can tend to be wasteful in this country, and that we do not spend money well, particularly on big projects. Well, or is that unfair?
On the second point, I think many countries get it wrong. Germany had an airport that they couldn't open, and many countries get those big projects wrong. But on the first point, definitely, I think there's a difference in Ireland between we're more Mediterranean than Northern Europeans. So the Northern Europeans, you know, waste of taxpayers' money is a big issue regularly in Northern European elections. It tends not to be in Southern European elections. So I think I can't remember a single time when waste of taxpayers' money has been a general election issue, if anybody can recall. But I don't think it is. We live in very unpredictable times. Maybe this time will be different. But I do know the Red Sea poll today asks about competence in nine different areas. Yeah, it doesn't ask about waste of taxpayers' money.
Yeah. Okay.
It has to rate the parties.
Which again, back
to
your point, Elaine, that a few days ago this was going to be a major issue in the election, but it's not on there. Elaine, tell us about Jerry Hutch running for election. On bail at the moment in Spain, basically?
Yes, 100,000 bailed from Lanzarote and Ali Bracken in today's Sunday Independent. And I think I'd have to say that Ali Bracken probably has one of the political scoops of the year. She had this a couple of weeks ago, even though she's not a political correspondent, that Jerry the Monk Hutch.
Yeah, I think the Sunday World had it as well.
The Sunday World has it on the front of today's papers, or their paper today. And it's expected that the Monk will arrive home as soon as tomorrow and then register as a candidate to run in the general election. He's saying that this is the people's choice and this is what the people want. That is a highly contested Dáil Ceantar already. You have the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, in there, and a lot of very high profile candidates.
We also have, it's a fascinating constituency. So we have Pascal Donoghue of Fine Gael, we have Nessa Horrigan of the Green Party, and we have Gary Gannon of the Social Democrats. So they're the four outgoing TDs. We have Mary Fitzpatrick of Fianna Fáil, we have Mary Sherlock of Labour, we have Janice Boylan of Sinn Féin. Maliki Steenson, an independent. We have Claire Daly, an independent for change, who recently announced she was running there. We have Owen Canavan of People Before Profit, Ian Smith of AIN2, and now Jerry Hutch, independent. So there will be people will be watching that constituency.
I think definitely. And whether, you know, Nessa Horrigan of the Greens can hang on might be a symbol could happen across the country.
OK, we won't get into speculating too much about that. Aisling, just before we leave election-y stuff, IBEC on the front of the Sunday Business Post is calling for new supports to offset, it says, highest electricity costs in Europe, according to Daniel Murray.
Yeah, sure. It was just, I suppose, again, it was kind of coming back to the piece, you know, about the renewables and the cost of doing business. You know, I think it kind of comes back to the ability to assess what's going on in the public. You know, like I think especially given the week and, you know, the issues of cost of living is going to be a big factor, and housing is going to be a big factor. But
just to take a detour for a second. So you're living down in rural Ireland now. You gave a good shout out for farming already.
Yes.
What are the other issues you think are on people's minds?
I suppose just given the area where I am in County Clare, health is a big part, and I suppose the local hospital, or the lack of, I suppose, confidence that we have in the hospital, and just not having the capacity to deal with the population that it needs to.
So health is potentially a number one issue in some areas, depending health on what people's experience is part of it. Those areas are.
I think also housing, naturally. And I suppose from a rural perspective, I suppose there's a frustration there about the inability to be able to get planning for houses that are not in towns and cities. And obviously there's a whole environmental piece on that as well. But I suppose it's very frustrating where you can't buy a house, but equally you refuse permission to build a house on your lands. and a lot of rural voters. And then I suppose a lack of certainty is a huge part of it. You know, in terms of you know, as I said, like even in terms of making announcements on different infrastructural projects, you know, the road to Cork, my in-laws are living in Cork, and it was announced, and you know, several years ago, but nothing has happened on it. So empty promises, I suppose, is part of it as well, that people, rural people, would be a bit frustrated with.
Okay, Scott, you've been listening thoughtfully there and nodding here and there. What are your, as an outsider again, your thoughts on all that conversation?
I mean, one thing that I'll be interested in that I was told, again, as part of my education coming to Ireland, is the unexpected issue that can suddenly come up in an Irish election. I think pensions was the one in 2019. So you always wonder if there's another one that could come out. But I think beyond that, it's still very much, as we're having this discussion today, as we're discussing the Irish meeting, that there are rules of the game. There will be differences over these issues, but there is a level of civility that is taking place in terms of where Ireland,
you're making
needs to
us feel very good about ourselves there. We are conducting this in a very civilized fashion. Elaine, we mentioned the poll, so will I give it, or will you give a rundown of the state of the parties in the poll just quickly?
Yeah, well, the parties, they're roughly where they've been for the previous polls. Fine Gael 22, Fianna Fáil 21, Sinn Féin 18.
So there's no change, Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin up one in this poll at 18,
And all of the smaller parties are roughly where they have been in previous polls. The Greens 4, Social Democrats 6, Independents on 15%. So I think that group, which is not really a group because it's so disparate and goes from, you know, far right to far left and everything in between, is on 15%. So I think that'll come down to constituency by constituency how well Independents do. You then have the new party, Independent Ireland, on 3%. Labour on
3%. Down two.
Labour on 3%. Ain't two up 2 to 5%, and then we have Solidarity or a People Before Profit on 2%.
Down one, and the Sock Dems we mentioned there, 6% up one. And listen, we just, given people have been talking a lot about polling and everything this week in America and stuff. So the poll is based on interviews with 1,208 people, some online, some in person, over the last week. But this is the key bit here that I think, I was reading a very interesting guy yesterday on polling. The margin of error here, right, in this poll is plus or minus 3%. Now, I know you hear that line and you're not thinking about it at home. Bear in mind, that means 3% either way, those figures could be off. So what this guy, a polling expert, was suggesting yesterday is that pollsters need to start being clearer about what a poll means. And instead of giving, like, they give the specific numbers, but what they should say, and this was his words, it's a fuzzy range. It's a fuzzy range of about 6% there. So, you know, that's almost, they're a snapshot and they're also a range.
Could I just say, Brendan, I think it's important with opinion polls to look at the trends over a year or 2 years or whatever, rather than just look from one to the next. Because nearly always with these polls, the changes are within the margin of error. Therefore, from 1 week or 1 month to the next, the changes are insignificant. You need to look at the trend over a longer period of time to see if there is a trend. Is one group going up? So, for example, the Independents have been rising over the past year as a block. Just one example. So I think it's very much focused on trend rather than just one poll to the next.
Yeah, and then that could all change wildly in the next 3 weeks as well. Okay, we'll take a break. Professor Scott Lucas, Dan O'Brien, Elaine Loughlin and Aisling Meehan are staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still here. Professor Scott Lucas, Dan O'Brien, Elaine Loughlin and Aisling Meehan. So we will stop gazing at our own navels now and do a bit of judginess on America instead. Aisling, kick us off here. Lucinda Creighton in the Sunday Business Post. Trump won as Democrats failed to learn 2016 lessons, is the piece you picked.
Yes, sorry. Now,
are you ready? Are you ready there? Okay.
This one tick.
Why don't I go to you? So, Scott, what happened?
Well, a lot of trees died for a lot of commentary this morning. Perhaps being well-meaning, I think, is quite often sometimes superficial and even misleading. And I need to explain why with a couple of facts. The first thing that I think is striking is that Donald Trump's vote this year is about the same as he got in 2020, almost exactly. However, Kamala Harris's vote is down more than 10 million from what Joe Biden received in 2020.
So what's that telling us?
I think it's telling us there wasn't really a surge in terms of this big enthusiasm for Trump. A lot of people will support Trump, but he ran, let's be honest, he ran a campaign which was very much one of trying to prey upon anger and resentment and fear quite often. So it wasn't like there's a positive affirmation there. Where the Democrats fail was they failed to get out their own people in terms of what do you think we can do for you in the next 4 years? And I think...
What was their message?
And this is an interesting thing because the Democrats, there's a lot of talk which is misleading. And I just want to knock this aside, that the Democrats were out there being woke. That's a meaningless term which is out there. There's
were they out there being anything? At the start of September,
Kamala Harris put out a series of proposals, did it in a speech in North Carolina. She put out proposals in terms of child care and child benefit. She put out proposals in terms of first-time buyers trying to get onto the housing ladder. She put out proposals in terms of trying to expand Obamacare. She put out proposals to deal with the high cost of university tuition, which is a big issue in the States.
It sounds like she thought she was running in an election in Ireland. That'd be all the kind of stuff that everybody
jumped on
here.
But two things then happened. One is that I think the nature of the U.S. media environment is very different from where it is in Ireland. I think spectacle can overtake issues. And secondly, I think the Democrats simply did not try to say, folks, this is what you need to be voting on for the next 4 years, because it will be worse under Donald Trump. You will not have this prospect of having a turnaround in the economy. They didn't get across their facts on immigration. And I'll just give you one fact that I don't think anybody noticed in the U.S. election. Undocumented immigration across the U.S. Mexico border, which has spiked between 2019, Trump years, to 2022, Biden years. This year, undocumented immigration is down 77% across the U.S. border. And the Democrats didn't get it across. And with respect, a lot of the U.S. media would prefer to talk about whether or not immigrants are eating cats and dogs rather than the salient facts.
Obama was deporting huge numbers of people every day, wasn't he?
Yeah, the Democrats have been quite tough on the border. And if you go back to the start of...
They didn't manage to get this simple point across, no?
Or the point that at the start of 2024, there was a border security bill, perhaps the most significant border security bill in decades, agreed between Democrats and Republicans. It was on the verge of passing the U.S. Congress. And then one man put out a message to the Republicans, which is, don't you vote for this. And that man was Donald Trump. And that all sort of went by the by. And a lot of the commentary today still doesn't get it. The Business Post does, with respect. The Business Post really gets it, not only in terms of what this means for the U.S., but what it means for the U.S. and Ireland. But I want to leave you with four words, which were my immediate reaction when I did my first interview on Wednesday, having had no sleep, which is we need to recognize, because some leading Irish political and legal figures are being complacent about this, because I heard them this week, is we need to realize this is not normal. What is going to happen in America in the next few months, 4 years, will not be normal, and we need to be prepared for it.
Okay. So, Aisling, counterpoint to that theory. Are you ready with Lucinda Craig?
I am,
Trump
sorry,
won
yes.
As Democrats failed to learn 2016 lessons.
I think she did a very good piece today. Democrats continue to tell voters what they should feel and think rather than listening to and understanding their concerns and addressing them. And I suppose, she had mentioned about Democrats call it progressive, Republicans use the term woke. So it's I suppose, the ideology versus listen to what people are saying on the ground. And I think that's going to become very prominent in our own elections. The other piece that I just felt, and it's going back to Scott's point, is, about the policy issues. And I suppose that we'll say the Democrats were maybe criticised for not being firm enough in policy. But then there's lots of things that the Republicans spoke about, and there was no policy. I suppose there was no proposals behind it.
Different rules.
I suppose the point I want to make is that I think a little bit that she was held to higher account. She was held, than the other side, and that's obviously a little bit unfair, very unfair. But I think it goes back to the basic point about, you know, listening. And I think one of the parties has pivoted since they got a new leader in that. They're more aware of that and certainly saying it more. And even the other pieces, other political parties, there's other pieces in the party in the papers this
in
week.
Ireland.
And equally like that about the cost of living. Like it's really dominating the papers today. And it goes back to Elaine's point, you know, the other things that we were thought might come up, but like the cost of living and immigration are huge parts of all today's papers.
Yeah. So Scott, you're shaking your head there, but I referred yesterday to Francis Fukuyama, who I know he didn't quite get the end of history right, but a very well respected commentator on the liberal project in general. My colleague, a great book last year, I think, Liberalism and Its Discontents, and his point is that liberalism got twisted first into neoliberalism, which did nothing for ordinary people, and globalization and trade that we're also obsessed with now did nothing for the traditional working class voter. Then got twisted into woke liberalism, which also did nothing for the traditional working class voter. And then Trump swoops in on that and grabs the people that should be voting for the Democrats.
I was shaking my head at that invocation of the word woke when almost everybody who uses the word woke doesn't realize what the definition of it is. I mean, the word woke is not some left-wing extreme concept. It's about being culturally and socially aware. It's about being aware about issues like women's rights. It's about being aware about issues about rights for different minorities, whether it's ethnic or racial minorities. It's about being aware about the balance between the economy and the environment. It's actually just simply about being smart. But what has happened is that, again, because of the nature of the U.S. media environment, the term has been converted into this fact-free battering ram that you just hammer against people. And so, again, while acknowledging the Democrats did not succeed in getting the message across, policy across, and what you're seeing even in the papers today is this idea that the Democrats were running on cancel culture and wokeism, et cetera, and they weren't. They actually were running on very important issues about women's rights, about LGBT rights, about the question of a green economy. And until we stop using the word woke, we're not going to get to grips with reality. We're going to get led by the nose, especially by the way that Trump frames this as he wages his own culture wars against groups within the United States.
Okay, Dan, before we get to what this might mean for Ukraine, do you want to say anything to that?
Wow, I think you could do a whole show on this. Well, what I would describe the woke, I wouldn't use it, the term woke, I'd use the term illiberal left. So there has definitely been a movement towards the illiberal left. So things like defunding the police, anything to do with the discussion around transgender issue, immigration, that immigration was good, open the border, academic freedom and cancel culture. So these are things that have some people on the traditional liberal left have moved to become illiberal. They will not accept another point of view. There has to be one view on something and you're a racist, terrible person if you hold that view. So I think that is what a lot of people have pushed back against in the centre and on the right. I'm not sure how much we disagree on that, but like it's a sort of philosophical discussion about, and I'm not sure how much time you want to.
Yeah.
But there is definitely an illiberal right in the shape of somebody like Viktor Orban and an illiberal left in the shape of people who are conventionally called woke. I don't like to use that term. I prefer to use the term illiberal left.
Okay, well, I think we got a flavour of both sides of it there. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, look, I think we're going to be coming back to that discussion for years probably. Dan, to more bread and butter issues, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent today by Ilya Novikov, Russia open to proposals by Trump on Ukraine war.
Yeah, well, like, look, from you know, as I said at the outset, the biggest issue here is Donald Trump is not a warmonger. He's an isolationist. He wants America to get as much money out of different people. And we in Europe have been for 75 years more through the Second World War dependent on the United States for our security. Now, there is a very real risk that Donald Trump pulls the plug, does a deal with the most militarily powerful country in Europe, which is also an imperialist dictatorship in the shape of Russia. And where are we then?
Okay. So can I ask you about that? A deal's going to be done at some stage, right?
Yes, you know, it could be a frozen conflict that goes on for many years as after
but
his first invasion.
All wars roughly end in a deal, right? We're not giving... We're here being all holier than thou. We're better than Trump. Europe has never given the Ukrainians enough to win. Like, this is... I'm just being devil's advocate here. We give them enough to keep surviving while their country's destroyed and tens of thousands of their young men are killed. And we're kind of poo-pooing the idea that somebody might try to end the war.
Well, I'm not sure there is anything that, even if money was not an issue for Europe and the United States, I'm not sure there is anything that they could do in terms of providing stuff short of military nuclear weapons that would fundamentally change the dynamic. And Scott knows a lot more about that sort of military stuff than I do. But there is a risk of a nuclear war here. So, you know, the West, European and Americans have to be conscious that Putin, if pushed into a corner, could go down the route of using nuclear weapons. Now, him and his people have threatened that openly.
So again, this is a delicate balance. Is a deal not a good thing?
See, it depends what kind of deal you're talking about. So let's talk about the reality of where we are. First of all, it was with the help of U.S. and European support and the international community that Vladimir Putin didn't overrun all of Ukraine, including Kyiv. That's a huge achievement. He lost. He lost with his initial invasion. But where he is his last gamble to get this 27% of Ukraine that he has was Donald Trump. Because when the Kremlin refers to peace talks, they are referring to a condition that the international community accept their annexation, not only of Crimea, which they've had since 2014, but of four regions in Ukraine, two in the south, two in the east. They don't even occupy all of those four regions. But Putin announced in September 2022, these are part of Russia. So when Trump says, I can get peace within 24 hours, that peace within 24 hours is by accepting that Russian point of view as being the starting point for talks. I actually think we're going to wind up...
But the other starting point for talks is that Ukraine says we give away no territory whatsoever, right? And that's their starting point. Is that not how a deal gets done? I saw Jens Stoltenberg, the former head of NATO, was asked, right? And he was reluctant to answer the question. He was asked, how does this end for Ukraine? And reluctantly, he said, well, Finland fought a really good battle against the Russians, the Winter War in, when was it?
1939, 1940.
Yeah. And he said they ended up losing 10% of their territory, but they had secure borders. So there is territory going to be lost.
So in 20 seconds, what we're going to wind up with probably, if we don't capitulate to Putin, is going to be a parallel to West Germany, East Germany in the Cold War, what is still free Ukraine, about 75% of the country, but a Ukraine that can come into NATO facing about 25% being held by Russia.
Okay. Look, I want to have a look as well at what the Trump presidency could mean for Ireland, obviously, but we'll take a quick break first. Professor Scott Lucas, Dan O'Brien, Elaine Loughlin and Aisling Meehan are staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, our panel is still with us. Professor Scott Lucas, Dan O'Brien, Elaine Loughlin and Aisling Meehan. And we've talked about the international dimension of Trump, but of course the Irish dimension is much more important to all of us. So, Elaine, the Fianna Fáil leader has an interview in the Business Post today where he's addressing this. And maybe tell us as well, you've been talking to politicians and that during the week and to candidates, mm-hmm. as they now are. What's the general vibe about the Trump win?
Yeah, and I think now that the dust has settled and we are very much aware of what is going to happen over the next 4 years, we will have a Trump White House. We're hearing more about what that may look like and who will be appointed to key portfolios. And then the implications of a Trump presidency, both on Ireland and Europe. And I know European leaders meeting for an informal summit in Budapest on Thursday and Friday. This was a significant topic of conversation because obviously the Republican leader in the White House versus what could have been a Democratic White House has very different implications for Europe and in particular Ireland. And as you said, the Fianna Fáil leader is interviewed in today's Sunday Business Post and he is warning that the world is in turmoil. He mentions Sudan, the Middle East, but then focuses on Trump and a Trump White House. And we do know that ahead of the elections this week, that Trump had mentioned, you know, tariffs being placed on EU products coming into the US, and perhaps more importantly from us, reducing corporation tax to 15%. Ireland has a unique, I suppose, bonus every year from the amount of corporation tax that is taken in from roughly about 10 key companies. We're talking about €1 out of every 8 is coming from those, whether they're the tech sector or the pharma sector. And the Fianna Fáil leader is saying that Trump is entitled to reduce corporation tax because we did it for many years, but then warning that this, as I said, could have very negative connotations. And I think all parties this week around the Dáil, before the Dáil was dissolved, were also very worried about what may unfold in the coming years.
Dan, how bad is this? I guess you've two schools of thought here. One is that Trump will do exactly what he says, and that he said he's going to do it quickly as soon as he gets in, and we will potentially have all the levers with no opposition to do it. On the other hand, you have people say, well, look, he kind of did it the last time and it didn't matter that much, and he won't get it together to do it. And
okay, well, first of all, the last time you were kind enough to have me in during the summer, I said that the biggest near-term risk to the Irish economy is Donald Trump.
Okay.
I still believe that. Now, as you say, there's a range of outcomes. He can do exactly what he said, or it can be slightly less. Let me just make it very clear that what he did during the, and Ian Guider picks up this well in his piece, that what he did in his first term was minuscule compared to what he's talking about here. What he's talking about here, nothing has been seen since the 1920s when this very famous protectionism bill came through in the 1920s that contributed to the Great Depression. This is of that scale. So what we saw during his first term was just tweaking. If he comes in, he slaps a tax on everything that's shipped into the United States. That is a game changer for the global trading system. Ireland is, we ship more per person to the United States than Mexico or Canada, its immediate neighbours. More than
Whoa.
So every
not per capita.
Per capita. Everyone sitting at this table, and every man, woman, and child in the country, last year we shipped €10,000 worth of goods to the United States. Now, as I say, that is on a per person basis more than Mexico and Canada, its immediate neighbors, far more than anyone else in Europe. So if he slaps this tax and companies in Ireland decide that this is changes their margins and they decide to shift, if they can, shift their production to the United States, that has a potentially very big issue for us, particularly the pharmaceutical sector, which is one of the jet engines of this economy. So this poses a Brexit scale risk. Put it another figure, we export 3 to 4 times more to the United States than we do to Britain. Now, we knew Brexit was big and was going to be big. So in my view, I think we need a Brexit scale response to this, a mapping exercise immediately to start looking at where the really difficult points are. And there is some small things we can do in terms of lobbying in Brussels and lobbying in Washington and to try and pick out those things that we could possibly tweak at the margins to minimise the damage.
So, you know, Shinzo Abe, the former Japanese leader, had a formula for Trump. He was incredibly successful in dealing with him, and I think managed to mitigate against Toyota being basically wiped out by tariffs. Flattery, golf, and distraction. He used to give him golden putters and stuff. He'd bring him golfing, my great friend Donald Trump, and it worked. Scott, is he going to do all this?
We don't know. And the problem here is that Trump can be chaotic, unpredictable. But Dan's absolutely right for two reasons. First of all, Donald Trump is a transactional politician. So it's whoever flatters him the most. To pick up on your point there, the Irish ambassador during his first term was Dan Mulhall. And Dan used to meet Donald Trump out on the golf course to make sure that Ireland wasn't punished over trade. And
we
over
need
visas.
To be voting for golfers. They don't need to put it on their election leaflets.
And
I play golf.
That's quite good. But the bigger risk that goes beyond the transactional is we're not just talking about individual policies like corporation tax or talking about tariffs. The Trumpists, the diehard Trumpists who are around him, and this is the Project 2025 threat, are going to try to take control of U.S. agencies. They're going to try to take control of the Treasury. They're threatening to take political control of the Federal Reserve, which will have huge effect on interest rates, and take control of the State Department, with huge effects on diplomacy and take control of the military.
No, time is against us, Scott. So just on what we've seen so far, there's only been really a couple of announcements. I think people took a bit of sucker from his chief of staff because she goes back to Reagan and she seems like an old-fashioned functioning Republican, as much as a lot of people didn't like them at the time. But how is it looking? Is it looking like a bunch of cranks around him, or might there be adults in
there? There are already people around him who we know will be there, whether they get key positions. So the xenophobic Stephen Miller, who is very, very much pushing for deportations and pushing for tariffs. We know that Richard Grenell, who was, let's say, a very confrontational ambassador to Germany, not very diplomatic, is possibly going to be the Secretary of State. But I think more broadly, a series of people who are around Trump who may get positions were these people who in Project 2025 effectively said, you go out, take control of the agencies, and tear the U.S. system down.
Okay, which in fairness, let's just say that a lot of Republicans have been saying that is the Heritage Foundation. Trump has disowned it and it's not going to happen.
Trump knew what was going on with this all along. That's not exactly true.
Okay, Aisling, I didn't get to you, but you had picked Gary Murphy's piece, which I think sums up maybe what our position is at the moment. Let's hope Trump doesn't keep his promises. I think that's probably our Hail Mary at the moment. Okay, thank you very much to my panel this morning, Professor Scott Lucas, Professor of U.S. and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD, Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs, Elaine Loughlin, Political Editor of the Irish Examiner, and Aisling Meehan, Farmer, Solicitor and Tax Consultant.